So today I'm going to talk about the four worlds of Kabbalah, and our special treat for today is that we're going to have a short video by Lon Milo Duquette, because he can explain it much better than I can. So I will, I have this video capability over here, and we may have to cluster close in order to see it, but it's well worthwhile. I want to start out with kind of a high level abstraction. Do you all know what the taxonomic name for human is? Homo sapiens? It's actually Homo sapiens sapiens. And that two sapiens is important, because what it means is man who knows, and who knows that he knows. So we are, as far as we know, the only species that is capable of regarding our own thoughts, of looking not only outward at the world, but looking back inward to see how we think about what we're perceiving, how we think about our feelings, and so forth. So this is the important step in becoming that has brought us to the point where we are right now, that has caused civilizations to rise, that has given rise to all art and great philosophy and thought and religion and all of the other things that are less wonderful about being human, but which are part of us nonetheless. So the process that we are going through by very virtue of the fact that we are assembled in a place talking about the subject of Kabbalah, is adding another sapiens to our species name, that we are learning to become awareness of the awareness behind the awareness. There's an Indian, I speak of Eastern Indian philosophy called satsang, and this is the process of looking at that center within you that is aware and discovering what it truly is. And this can be a very flash of lightning kind of enlightenment, or it can be a slow awareness that there really is something more than just the meat puppet with a brain at the top. And through your studies of Kabbalah, should you choose to pursue it, this awareness begins to flower. And I hope that for some of you this has begun already. And if you're diligent in your studies, I'm certain that new awarenesses will come into being as a result. The second high-level abstraction that I want to introduce at the start is the idea of the holographic universe. Are you familiar with this concept? Holographs are an interesting extension of the process of photography. It uses some of the same underlying principles, but it does something much more and much more interesting. When I first heard about holographs, I thought they were really neat because they give the ability of creating a three-dimensional a representation within a crystal or what have you of that which is being photographed. But there's more. And this is the part of it that relates most closely to our growing understanding of Kabbalah. That if you take just a small fragment of a hologram, instead of, you know, like if you take a photograph and you nip off a corner, you'll have a foot. But if you nip off a corner of a hologram, you will have the whole image in there. It will be fuzzier and less detailed than the entire hologram. But it really does contain the essence of that image, such that if all you had was this little piece, you would really know what was going on. So the tree of life that we've been talking about is that little piece. It is the fragment of knowledge and understanding that is inserted into our world, and we can look at that And by looking at it with care, with practice and meditation, and moving all the way around it so that you can see its various angles, at some point you will have an opening of your consciousness. The way that that Lan Duquette describes this is that as you study Kabbalah, you learn to connect everything in the universe to everything else until you go a little bit crazy in a socially acceptable kind of way, and suddenly you understand what it's all about. So
that happens in the last class?
Yeah, right. Yeah, it is my sincere hope that that we all have that kind of a magnificent epiphany, but maybe not. maybe not during the course of the classes. So, the four worlds of Kabbalah sort of map onto the tree as we've discussed it up to this point. And if you turn over the handout, you'll see my representation of how this is. It's almost as if there are four trees in the four worlds. And students of Kabbalah who have been at it for a while realize that four is just the beginning, that there's vastly more information available than that. But if you start at the bottom of the tree, in the what's called Asaya, that is our physical world, and that is that little fragment of the hologram that we have a hold of. And each one of the four worlds that are above that are broader and more abstract and harder to grasp, but simply by knowing that they exist, your ability to get to the point where you can achieve some sort of a concept of this begins. So the four Hebrew letters that represent the four worlds of Kabbalah are Yod, He, Vav, He. And if you look on the first page of the outline, you'll see it is written, and remember that Hebrew is written from right to left. Yes, pardon me, I'm challenged in this domain. So it begins with the Yod, which is a little thing that looks like a candle flame. And it's said that the candle flame is the by the breath of God blows the candle flame and blows the rest of the Hebrew alphabet into existence. And so that begins, that is the representation of the highest of the four worlds, and then He and Vav and He represent the three below that. The Yod, He, Vav, He, since there aren't really vowels in the Hebrew language, it can be pronounced in a whole variety of ways, maybe hundreds of different ways. And the one that's it's most commonly pronounced is Yahweh or Jehovah, though Jews don't pronounce the name because it is the most holy name. They will either call it the name or they'll call say Adonai, which, what does that mean?
Lord.
The Lord. Lord, exactly. So those who have read the Bible will see the Lord referred to, or the Lord God, and that is the translation of that word, Adonai. The word is part of the verb to be in various ways. So when we recall the phrase, let there be light, that's part of that. That I believe that if you were to look at a Hebrew, at the Hebrew of this, that it would involve Yod, He, Vav, He. Does that sound familiar. I think that's how that works. So these four worlds represent everything that goes from the, I'm not going to say not understandable, but the not understood high deity, the one, the creative force of the universe, down to us. And the things in between are important steps, and I'll give a couple of words about that, and then Mr. Duquette will make it make sense. So Atziluth, or Atziluth, or Atzilut, however you prefer, is the highest form, the highest expression, and it's somewhat argued whether this is represented just in the sphere of Keter, or whether Keter, Chachma, and Bina are part of the, if you want to look just at the vertical representation of the basic tree, if that is what that's part of. But it's I spoke of the point source from which everything else arises, and it is as abstract as things can get. So you might imagine that it has the ability to create, and in doing so it has created first an essential masculine and an essential feminine principle for that duality, that battery that powers the lightning flash that makes everything come into existence. Underneath the archetypal world, Atziluth, is Bria, the creative world. And this is the most essential ideas of things. The big ideas that people ask basic questions about. What is the world made of? Where does the universe come from? Things of that nature. It's said to be the world of archangels, and I want to say a word or two about archangels. These are enormous, powerful, and eternal beings, and they are really not like us in any meaningful sense of the word, though they might appear to humans in human form. They're the kind of thing that would blow all of your circuit breakers if you were to encounter an archangel in the raw form. I've heard it expressed that the archangels are kind of like a large artificial intelligence, that they don't really have a kind of soul that gives us the personality. They have a vast intelligence, but they really are responsible for certain tasks within the order of creation. And as you may remember from the last session, each sphere has its own archangel. And those archangels are responsible for that aspect of the creative process as we go down from the top of the tree. Below, where we're starting to get a little bit more into the understandable part of the four worlds, is Yetzirah, and that's called the formative world. And that I think we could probably fairly say that does encompass the spheres of Netzach, Hod, and Yesod. So here is the world that sort of is the blueprint shop of our four layers of creation. You may be familiar with the concept that Plato spoke about of the forms, and that's capital F forms, where there is a basic shape that describes everything in the world in its most abstract form. So if you were to take something that is like this, and then you were to add something like this to the bottom of it on that side, and this to the bottom of it on that side, you can very quickly see that what I'm describing is a table. So the archetypal table that is the basis for every real table is that simple form, it's that simple idea. So we believe that in this world of Yetzirah, that all of the objects, the archetypal human, the archetypal chair, the archetypal what have you, it exists in that, and it requires the full force of creation to bring this into being in the world.
So when we talked in other forums about creating a thought form,
mm-hmm.
in the next plane, is that what we're talking about?
Kind of.
Here?
Kind of.
And if it's something that hasn't already been thought of, but you're putting thought and intention
mm-hmm.
into it, that's
I would say that when you create a thought form, you are most likely accessing something that has its basic shape, if you will, described already, and you are putting into it your own idea of how that should be and adding your own energy to it to bring it into being.
Okay.
There's another good image that gives us a little bit of an idea about the nature of what the world of Yetzirah is, and that's another idea from Plato, which is the shadows on the wall of the cave. So he spoke about a cave that contained a bunch of prisoners who were all chained so that they had to face the wall all the time, and behind them was a fire, and there were beings moving around the fire such that they would cast their shadows on the wall, and that was all that the prisoners were capable of seeing. So they could only infer from what they saw in those shadows on the wall what that reality that lie behind them, that was out of their ability to perceive, contained. And Plato supposes that by broadening our awareness in the ways that we have available to us through Kabbalah and various other meditative techniques, that we can break that chain and that we can turn around and see what actually is responsible for the shadows that we see on the wall. Any of that make any sense at all? Good. And finally, we get to Asaya, which is the material world, and that is us. That's everything that we see around us, everything from the smallest subatomic particle to the most vast galaxy or structure in the universe. And we are inclined to believe from everything that we're taught growing up that's all there is. But science is beginning to discover that what we thought of as all there is just a small fraction of it. That there are things, for example, an atom has a nucleus, which is a bunch of little particles clustered together. And it has an electron shell. And the electron shell, in terms of its distance in terms of the size of the nucleus, is vastly far away. It's like the distance from the sun to Pluto. So most of an atom is totally empty space, total vacuum. So you can imagine that, knowing that, understanding that everything that you know, that you think of as solid, is really not. That we are living in the midst of an illusion. We are making what is very insubstantial seem very real and solid. Not only seem very real and solid, but make it seem like it's the only thing that there is. And it really isn't. And it's my supposition, and I don't know, I guess you'd have to ask other experts whether this idea holds up, but because there is so much empty space that makes up what we know of as reality, there's a lot of room for other realities to exist, not out there, but in here, nested inside of our atoms. Other rates of vibration, because really an atom, all of the matter is in the state that it is because it vibrates at a very specific rate, and things that are vibrating at a different rate could be right inside of our own realm, and we don't normally see them because first of all, we're told that such things don't exist. And secondly, because we're so distracted by the glitter of our material world, that we don't really have the focus, for the most part, to see the things that are there all the time. And you know, the things that are there all the time, I'm speaking of beings without bodies that coexist with our plane, and you know, they may be there, or they may not be there. I have a lot of reason to believe that they are, and some people see them, some people hear them, and what have you, and they've been part of our lore since humans have been recording their speech or writing things down. So it's I have every reason to believe that there's something to the existence of spirits of all kinds, and I think that they're right here with us. They're not just off in heaven or what have you. So any questions about what I've spoken of so far?
It's the equivalent of all the radio stations that are playing right now in this room, but
right.
The one.
Exactly. A far better teacher than I has actually given that analogy to us, that that there are right now we're completely interpenetrated by radio waves of all kinds, all of the cell phone stuff, television and broadcast radio and things like that. No, don't think about that too hard. It's scary. But really, it's true. And if you don't have a receiver for any of that stuff, if you don't have a receiver, it is if it does not exist. You know, it consider that in the 17th century, if somebody came up with a time machine had burped out a cell phone, you know, it would be a perfectly functioning cell phone, but there wouldn't be anything to broadcast to it. And on the other end of the spectrum, if a time machine burped out a radio transmitter, there wouldn't be anything to receive it. So we are receivers not only for auditory information, visual information, tactile information, and so forth, but we are receivers for the very notion of our physical reality. And if it is possible for you to broaden your horizons, and there are techniques that allow you to do this. There are drugs you can take that will allow you to do this, though I definitely don't recommend it, having tried it myself. That can make you aware of other ways of perceiving reality that I think are just as valid as what we consider to be the only reality that there is.
Do you get close to that with Sweat Lodge?
Well, you know, I guess people's experiences will vary, and I neglected to mention that another fairly well-known way of being able to open yourself to other realities are things like physical privation, like Sweat Lodge will make you very uncomfortable, and sensory deprivation, that's a good one. You know, it's amazing how quickly people start hallucinating and believing that their hallucinations are real when they're in a total sensory deprivation environment. Fasting, lack of sleep, extreme pain, things like that will alter our reality so that we can open up to different ways of perceiving things. And sometimes it can be so profound that it changes you forever.
Mark,
mm-hmm.
I was reading something. You know how people say, oh, I caught such and such out of the corner of my eye?
Yes.
That there actually are more cones and whatever, so that what you think you're catching out of it, oh, it's just, but really you actually can see things that you might not see if you were looking directly.
Absolutely.
Which is why we see a lot of stuff in the spiritual realm will like catch it out of the corner of
right.
your eye.
Right.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Cool. I've almost
that
tripped
that
over my
uh-huh.
cat that died
yeah.
multiple
I
times
I don't know
because
how
she goes running by and I see her out of the corner of my eye. You know,
okay.
she's there. I mean, you know,
mm-hmm.
that's what I've been doing.
You may remember the Carlos Castaneda books, and I may have mentioned this in one of the earlier classes. That for me, this was one of my openings to the spirit realm, that Don Juan told Castaneda to become aware of what was going on in the periphery of his
mm-hmm.
vision, because that's where the ability to see, to perceive things that were not part of normal rational reality comes from. And I had an experience not too long ago where I was able to very briefly perceive the actions of a being that's associated with one of our elders. And it was one of those things where, you know, I knew that this being existed, and I am not my normal way of perceiving things, energetic things and spiritual things, is not visual. It's more auditory or inner perception.
Mm-hmm.
But I saw out of the corner of my eye, I saw this tall being hovering over him, and my rational mind wanted to say, oh, that's just a flash from the decoration hanging from the ceiling. But my heart was thudding out of my chest, and I knew that I could not deny that I was witnessing something. So that's corner of your eye. That's an important thing to pay attention to. So anything else, or shall we begin the video show?
Remember that the fact that we can't see too many channels at the same time
yes.
is a blessing.
Yeah.
Right.
If you if you've ever had the radio and the TV going on at the same
mm-hmm.
time and then took a phone call
yeah.
and continued the email that you were typing at the same time, there's a point where you get a little crazy and
uh-huh.
it's not necessarily
oh,
socially
yeah, exactly.
acceptable
exactly.
or useful.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. And I've also experienced the total blow-away sensory overload that LSD and mescaline can produce. And, you know, it's the kind of thing where the only thing you want to do at this moment is hide under the blanket.
That's too much information right there.
Yeah.
Yesterday exactly. I needed to pick up some things at like the dollar store, the Hermes discount. And I went in there and there was families in line, there were kids and they were being noisy. And just after being out in the woods and opening myself up a little more to surroundingness out there coming in here, I had to leave.
Yeah.
I didn't buy my Lysol.
A rude shock.
It's like I can't be in this here. I can't be in this.
Assaulted.
They weren't doing anything wrong. They weren't, just I had too many channels open. It was like, I can come back Monday when they're not here and buy the Lysol and the deodorant.
Exactly. Well, let me get this thing set up, and this is a fairly small screen, so you're probably going to have to cluster around to see it, but I think it's well worth it. So, circle nine.
To explain what these four worlds are about, I use an example of a chair. Let's say that all four of these worlds are a four-story building, and that everything in the universe, all the forces, all the energy, all the consciousness of the universe is represented as this four-story building. And we walk into the first floor and we see nothing but chairs. Chairs of every size and description. You got milking stools and you got lazy boys and you got couches and you love seats and every chair in the world is on that first floor. Well, there is a section of that floor for absolutely everything that manifests in the material world. There's a tin can section of that floor. There's a small vibrating appliance section of that floor. There's a duck section of that floor, okay? But just for this example, we're in the chair section. So it looks like a Wix furniture showroom of nothing but chairs. And we ask ourselves, where do these chairs come from? And we could say, well, the chairs come from wood and nails and upholstery and wool for the upholstery, but that's not true because there's a wool section, there's an upholstery section, there's a nail section, and it's all on the first floor. So the chair itself as a entity didn't come from the first floor at all. It came from the next floor up. And so we get in an elevator and we go one floor up from the ground floor and the elevator door opens and we don't see any chairs here, but we see blueprints for chairs like hanging from invisible wires all over the place. Okay, and there's no physical chairs, but there's these forms of chairs because this is the formative world we're in, Yetzirah, okay? And if we want to use the imagery of the Kabbalists, we actually see people walking around, maybe in white lab coats, the people that drew these chairs. And they've got pens and pocket protectors and pens, and they're kind of nerdy kind of people, because all they do is draw designs for these chairs. So in Kabbalistic parlance, these are angels. They're nerd angels, okay, up there in Yetzirah. Okay? And it's their job to set the pattern for all of those chairs to eventually manifest on that first floor. Okay? Can you sort of see it going from the specific, to the general? Okay, where do these nerd angels get their orders? How do they know that they're supposed to be working on chairs? They get their marching orders from one floor up. So we get in an elevator again, we go one floor up, the elevator door opens, and we only see one angel behind a big desk. And this guy looks like Thomas Edison. He's the Thomas Edison of chairs. I don't know if you know, but Thomas Edison, who invented everything in the entire 20th century, it seems like, he would just get this idea in the morning. He'd get this very strange idea, and he'd scribble something down on an envelope or a piece of paper, just something you could hardly read. And he would call up like one of his nerd angels from who worked for him, one of his engineers, and he would explain to them, you know, this, you know how something makes a vibrating sound when you rub it, you know, well, I want to make something that rubs on something else and maybe run that impulse down this wire to that diaphragm that we stole from Alexander Graham Bell and figure out a way to run it to another thing so it makes something wiggle and scratches another thing, and then rerun it back down another thing and till it comes out this big cone. I mean, literally, he would make such broad sweeping generalities, but he'll say, it's a phonograph, I need it in 2 weeks. And then that nerd angel who couldn't think of that big plan, okay, goes and takes that big plan, that inspiration, and goes ahead and builds a phonograph. And Edison gets it in 2 weeks, okay? Well, this is the Thomas Edison of chairs. And he might just be thinking something like, you know, people are going to die if they can't sit down. People can't stand up all day long. Their feet will get real big. They'll pop. They'll fall down. He just has this idea of people needing rest. And that he has this general idea that they need to put their buttocks down to take the weight off of it. Okay, that's all he says. I need a butt rester. And so he calls one of his nerd angels from downstairs and just says flat out, people gotta get off their feet. Invent me butt resters. And then they in turn go, oh wow, I never thought of that idea of a butt rester. Oh, well, we can make millions of different kinds of butt resters. Okay, this Thomas Edison up there on the third floor is an archangel. And an archangel represents huge, titanic forces of nature. We could look at gravity as being the archangel, gravity AL. Okay, but he's got angels working for him on the lower floor who's like drop AL or plop AL or slide or drag or droop AL. You see different aspects of gravity. You follow me? Okay. So that is the Thomas Edison of chairs is up there in Brya, the creative world, the archangelic world of the Hebrew Kabbalists. So you got Brya, the creative world, then under that yet Zaira, the formative world of the blueprints, and finally the world of chairs itself. But we got one more floor, and it's the very top floor, and in reality, it's the only real floor. Okay. And that's Atzilith, and it's called the archetypal world. And let's get in the elevator and go upstairs to that floor. And the elevator door opens, and we don't see anybody. Because we're so high in the creation cycle here, so high in the consciousness level of deity, that the male and female aspects of deity are still united in bliss. It's that bliss generator you hear so much about in Eastern mysticism, okay? So the male and female aspects of deity are, we can imagine them locked in a blissful and eternal embrace, but maybe one of them says, or one side says, oh, isn't bliss wonderful? Yes, bliss is wonderful. Oh, ecstasy is wonderful. Yes, ecstasy. Wouldn't it be nice if we could just stop? Wouldn't it feel good just to stop and we could start our bliss over again? And this abstract, supremely abstract concept of rest, just like the concept of the Hindu concept of pralaya, where every once in a while the universe just takes a rest. That concept of rest inspires that archangel in the floor beneath, that Thomas Edison, who gets the idea, a specific idea of rest. People got to get off their feet. And he, in turn, gives them to the more general angels that make every kind of butt rester on the planet, make the pattern for, and eventually it comes down to the material plane. So can you see worlds behind worlds, behind worlds? When you look at a chair, you're looking at angels that designed it, an archangel that conceived it, and the abstract concept that inspired it. Those are the four Kabbalistic worlds. And they have an exact counterpart in our own souls.
And that is much better than I could ever do. Thank you, Mr. Duquette.
But I wanted to see the rabbi's head talking out of the lab tray.